This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Fathers Never Die. It's been almost 5 years since my father died. There's a part of me that still doesn't quite believe it. I can still see him, hear him. We just live in different states, as it were. Father's Day can take on an unusual poignancy for those of us who have lost their fathers, physically, that is. Today on the podcast, we're going to listen to a few poems about our ghostly fathers. I'm joined by Nick Flynn, the memoirist and poet. He's the author of Another Bullshit Night in Sex City, which examines his relationship with both his parents. His book, The Reenactments, is about his experience during the making of a movie based on Another Bullshit Night in Sex City. I just can't say that title often enough. Nick, it has probably already been done, but it seems to me that someone could assemble a great anthology made up entirely of father poems, don't you think?
And it has been done.
Yeah. It has been done, okay. Yeah,
Jason Schindler did a great anthology almost 20 years ago now, probably. The great poet who we also lost recently, Jason Schindler.
Mm-hmm. I can think of a couple of greatest hits that would go into any anthology about fathers. Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. Mark Strand's elegy, The Empty Body. What about you? What are some of the great father poems in the language?
Well, you know, you think of Plath has her dark father poems.
Yes, Daddy, yeah.
You know, Sharon Olds has, you know, done a lot with fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Rethke's My Father's Waltz.
My Father's Waltz, right.
I think of Franz Wright writing about, you know, elliptically about his father, James Wright.
It's a rich emotional vein for poets to mine, fathers are. Mothers are too, but fathers in particular.
Yeah, Robert Hayden, I just thought of Robert Hayden.
Those Winter Sundays, yeah. Great poem. Many of them have the deepest yearning feelings that you can have outside of maybe romantic poetry in these father poems.
You know, here you and I are, Curtis, you know, both fathers, recording this for Father's Day, and being a father. And I have a daughter. My daughter is 8 now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to navigate it seems like there's a real natural connection between my daughter and her mother. It's sort of this natural. It's almost not even questioned. But with my daughter and I, it's always sort of being negotiated in some way.
Hmm.
There's the biological truth of it, of you know having come from the mother, the maternal instincts, the you know having to work against archetypes. You know, there's the in the Greek archetypes is a fathers are, you know, eating their children and, you know, like casting them adrift. And, you know, there are, you know, the bad mothers, but usually the mothers are more stepmothers or, in that sense, you know, stepmothers have been given an awful shake in the fairy tales and such.
But there's a little distance with fathers.
And unknowability too, I think. And I think it might be that the fathers don't know themselves in some way. Maybe trying to present a self. This is what a father should be or something, stern or should be, you know, comforting or should be. But it feels almost like it's enacted rather than embodied, perhaps. The role of the archetype of father for the man himself feels somewhat enacted, at least for me. I'm only talking about myself here.
Well, you have an extraordinary story, which we won't get into now. You have to get turned to Nick Flynn's memoirs for the story about his father, which is an amazing story. And we're going to hear a little bit about that when we hear you read a poem. I asked you to choose a poem by somebody else and one of your own poems for today's program. And you chose, for the other poem, you chose Father in Drawer by Lucy Brock Broido, which was published in Poetry Magazine in December of 2012. What drew you to this poem?
Well, Lucy is, you know, one of our masters. And I mean, she seems to come more from the lineage, this sort of older lineage of like Hopkins or Dickinson. Just her use of language, just the way it like rolls around in the mouth and in the mind and the body. She's seeking something through the sound of language that's really inspiring to me. It always has been. I've always loved Lucy's work.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lucy Brock Broido's father died in 1968, suddenly, of a cardiac event, she told us. And she and her sister were quite young at the time, and it was a total shock to the family. We recorded her reading the poem when it came out, and this is how she introduced it.
My sister and I both have the last photograph of my father. He's young and handsome. He's holding a pipe, and she keeps this photograph propped on her kitchen counter in Bethesda, Maryland, and with her small children, it kept being bumped off and going to the floor. And one day she called me to tell me she had put, we called him Daddy, that she had put this photograph in an obscure utensil drawer, and that every time that she opened this drawer, there was Daddy. And that was what occasioned the poem. But once it began to be written, it became much more formal and much darker.
And stranger. The poem takes place in Pittsburgh, where she grew up, and the poem mentions the Monongahela River, which meets the Allegheny River to form the Ohio River. Also, it's helpful to know that Brod is a city in Poland where the Broidos apparently come from. Here's the poem.
Father in drawer. Mouthful of earth, hair half a century silvering. Who buried him? With what? Make a fist for heart. That is the size of it. Also, directives from our DNA. The nature of his wound was the clock cicada winding down. He wound down. July, vapid, humid, sails of sailboats swelled, yellow boxes of cigars from Cuba plumped. Ring fingers fattened for a spell. Barges of coal bloomed in heat. It was when the catfish were the only fish left living in the Monongahela River. Though there were, they swore, no angels left, one was still bound in the very drawer of salt and ache and rendering, its wings wrapped in by the slink from the strap of his second wife's pearl satin slip, shimmering and still, as one herring left face up in its brine and tin. The nature of his wound was muscadine and terminal. He was easy to take down as a porgy off the cold Atlantic coast. In the old city of Broad, most of the few Jews left living still may have been at supper while he died. That same July, his daughter's scales came off in every brittle tinsel color, washing to the next slow yellowed river and the next toward west, Ohio bound. This is the extent of that. I still have plenty heart.
So, Nick, this is a very surprising poem. It starts, you think one thing is going to happen, and it really goes in a very, very different direction.
Where do you see the turn?
When she brings up angels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Though there were, they swore, no angels left. One was still bound in the very drawer of salt and ache and rendering. And that, to me, refers back to the picture of her father that she mentioned in the introduction. What about you? Where's the turn for you?
Yeah, that's. I would have said it was a pedantic poetry professor's question. just because I didn't want to point to that one in case there was another one for you. I was generally open to there being another moment in it. But that, yeah, when angels appear, then we're in another realm.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting. It's right about halfway through the poem, which is interesting too. The beginning is this setup. It's a, interesting, for expository information, July, vapid, humid, sails of sailboats. So we know what time of year it is. We know, we know from the title it's the father. We know that there's, the location with the name of the river.
And we know the river is polluted, as those rivers were back in the 1960s.
Yeah.
It was when the catfish were the only fish left living in the Monongahela River.
The bad old 1960s.
Yeah.
Now everything's good.
And the angel, but the angel appears suddenly, and then this weird mermaid stuff starts to happen.
Or the angels don't appear.
Oh.
There were no angels left.
Ah, right.
So suddenly there's a negation of angels that we didn't know existed.
Or one was still bound
in
the very drawer. Still bound is reminds me of stillborn, but mm-hmm. still bound suggests that somebody's inert, and it suggests that that's her father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then what happens in this poem?
Well, then it ends eventually. eventually we're done with the poem. But there's a moment where we sort of suggest, there's something suggested about the father, I think, by the word muscadine.
Which is the type of grape.
Which is a grape that you make cheap wine out of.
The nature of his wound was muscadine and terminal.
I don't know if it's a wine that is drunk like Mogan David, like during some religious ceremonies,
right,
or if the father, if somehow alcohol contributed to the father. I don't know. I'm not sure, you know.
It's vague. And the poem, this is not a realistic poem. It makes references to a realistic things.
So that, and that's why I would sort of put her in the category with Dickinson, to tell it slant, you know, not to, to sort of have more of an inference so that we get to have access to the, you know, poem. We sort of force us, it forces us to be in the poem with her by our wondering.
That same July, his daughter's scales came off in every brittle tinsel color.
That suggests the daughters are kind of fish-like, almost like mermaids, and they're losing the beauty of their scales. It's a very odd image.
Mm-hmm. Washing to the next slow yellowed river and the next toward west. So they're leaving. They're also leaving the home. And I like that at the end, the last line.
This is the extent of that. I still have plenty heart.
Yeah, why doesn't she say, I have plenty of heart, which would be the colloquial way to say it?
It seems almost like a Pittsburgh first-generation Pole, you know, Jewish Pole might speak that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's somehow embodying the father through language. I'm not sure if he was first generation, but at least embodying the culture of the father.
Mm-hmm. This is a traumatic situation. Her father died when she was a relatively young girl. What do you think it says about his persistence in her life?
It seems to me that this is like, as she said in her introduction, it started with this very tangible image of her sister putting the portrait of the father in a drawer in the house, and then opening it, and there's the father every time she opens the drawer. And what that is, I think this sort of, trying to capture that moment of strangeness, how the dead can reappear to us at unlikely moments. And sometimes there are moments that are set up for us so that we go to it. You know, she had to go to this drawer and open it. Obviously, she would forget sometimes, but she didn't have to put the father in that drawer there. So it was almost an intentional way of a mnemonic device to bring the father back at certain moments. It allowed her to do that. And I think that's what the poem is doing, too. It's just sort of letting that uncertainty and that randomness of memory, sort of trying to contain that, is what I would say.
And then it goes where it's going to go. You can't control that memory. It's just going to go where it's going to go.
Yeah,
a strange fantasy takes place.
You know, once the daughters become fish, then
all bets are off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to your poem now. It's called Kafka, and Franz Kafka, it's safe to say, had father issues himself. I think that's not what the poem is about, but I think that's probably why you begin the poem with Kafka, no?
Why do I begin the poem with Kafka? For me, there's some reason that I was like reading Kafka again right around the time that my father died. And I think it was just that moment of noticing in a biographical piece about Kafka that he had starved to death, which was, you know, becomes part of this poem.
That's where the poem begins, then it goes someplace very different. Let's hear it. Here's Kafka by Nick Flynn.
The cause of death seems to have been starvation. His throat closed, and so he was no longer able to swallow. On his deathbed, he was editing The Hunger Artist, which, perhaps ironically, perhaps not, he began working on before he was felled. My father will, the doctor tells me, also starve to death. He also cannot swallow. I have said no to the feeding tube because I imagine that is what I would want someone to say for me, but really, how the fuck do I know? The fact that I am the one who will pull the plug on him, and that I will pull it with one simple word, is in the realm of the unbearable, but apparently I will bear it. The doctor promises to make him comfortable, which means morphine. Nowadays, this is how the plug is pulled. Afterward, the money he buried under that tree, the take from all his bank jobs, all of it, will come to me. If I can just get him to draw me a map, if I can find the tree, if I can find his shovel. And the house, the mansion he grew up in, soon a lawyer will pass a key across a walnut desk, but even this lawyer will not be able to tell me where this mansion is. And my father's masterpieces, his many novels, mine, now to publish. I don't have to tell anyone I didn't write them, not a word.
Now, so the turn in this poem if we're going to go back to that, that it has to do with starts with the money under the tree. For me, it does. When suddenly we're in a different realm, we're in a realm of fantasy. Or is there money under the tree I know your story enough to know that there probably wasn't, and that your father probably did not write those novels and so on.
Yeah, the moment afterward, the money he buried under that tree. I mean, he would suggest that, he would imply that a lot, that there was
something out there that
there was more that he had he had made a killing from his robbing banks that was as yet undiscovered, and one day he would go and dig it up and live the life he was supposed to live. But yeah, he never did. We never found it. So that the money is still buried under that tree, at least in his imagination.
This doesn't feel to me like an elegy. Did you think of it as an elegy when you wrote it, or you thought of it as you're relating a specific event that happened?
Well, it's not elegiac in one sense, because in this poem, my father isn't dead yet.
That's right. We have to bring that, make that very clear.
Yeah, I had to arrange the book that this came from around. You can do anything you want in a book, but I decided to put this earlier in the book when he was still alive, and then have him die later in the book, mm-hmm. just to have the chronology there. Dead people come back all the time in my poems, so it doesn't necessarily, but this was about him dying. Mm-hmm. And it seemed important to have those beats go in the book in that order.
And you were literally, this is a very awkward situation for any son to be faced with, but you literally had to be the one to decide not to feed your father. And there's a wonderful line in here, how the fuck do I know? You're exactly right. How the fuck do you know what somebody wants when they're in that situation?
Well, in that line in there, I imagine that is what I would want someone to say for me.
Yes.
But we all really, think that when we're younger. I don't know what I, at that moment
exactly.
of death.
All think when we're kind of young and healthy, no way do I want to live like that. But then when we get to that point.
Yeah, you want another minute or something.
Yeah, you don't know what you want. But then you're forced to be in a position to choose for somebody else.
When I put him in hospice in his late 70s, 4 or 5 years before, and I went through the grieving process and making these decisions. And then, once a week I would talk to, I'd go visit him quite often. But I would talk to his hospice person quite often, and she just kept saying well, he keeps getting better, he's not and then she's saying this isn't really hospice anymore, we're just talking. And so they took him off hospice, and he just sort of hospice is supposedly a one-way ticket, and
yes,
he got off the train and stayed around for another 5 years. And in that time, the film version of Another Bullshit Night in Salt Lake City got greenlit. It got shot. Mm. Robert De Niro wanted to meet him, went and met him.
Oh, really?
We spent time together with De Niro talking about things. I showed him the final cut of the movie. We watched it together. And then he died. So he got, in those 5 years, a lot happened that, he became, in some way he found a level of fame that he'd always been seeking.
So it worked out.
He really wasn't ready to get on the train, to stay on the train at that point, apparently. Yeah, he hadn't accomplished. I mean, the one thing he wanted in his life was fame. That was, he put all his chips into that, so.
Jeez. So you've written quite a bit about your father in poetry and in prose. Do you think that will continue?
Now that, my father's passed on, and I feel like I resolved a lot with him in that writing, for so many years. I wrote about him for... I didn't meet him until I was in my late 20s, and then didn't really begin to resolve things with him until I was in my mid-30s, when I began writing Another Bullshit Night in Suck City. And in the course of writing that and writing other things, other subsequent books that he features in, I feel like I worked through a lot of, issues or the stuff that I had with him. Mm. And it really felt like when he died, I felt like we'd done all our work in some way. But does that mean he's going to come back or not come back?
Yeah, you never know, right?
I don't know. I'm not really in charge of that. My mother is a much more complicated figure for me that, can't quite, she doesn't quite stay in the box for me. So
we never truly, totally escape our parents.
Apparently, and then we become them.
we inflict it on another generation. Yeah, yeah. All right, Nick, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Nick Flynn's most recent book of poems is called My Feelings. You can read a sampling of his poems, as well as poems by Lucy Brock-Broido, up on our website. Let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.